This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
The economy is tipsy and phony. Oil is limited, running out, and the basis of everything we eat, buy, and do. And the climate is already off the rails, with worse to come. How do you keep sane in such a crazy world, now that you know? I'm Alex Smith. In this Radio EcoShock, we get professional help from New England clinical psychologist Kathy McMahon. She's gathered calls for help from people all over the world in her blog, peakoilblues.com. We're going to hear from Kathy's speech in Vancouver, Canada, October 18th. We only have time for some of the highlights. I'll tell you how to download the full 80-minute presentation as a free MP3 from our website, ecoshock.org, plus my extra interview with Kathy. Right now, we'll get the most by going straight to the introduction by John Cooksey, producer of the new film, How to Boil a Frog. Get ready for counseling, friendship, and a few laughs as we tour the darker tomorrows.
I met Kathy in the process of making a movie called How to Boil a Frog, which is now done. In the process of that, a friend named Anita Burke and also Rex were trying to widen my view from climate change, which I was obsessively focused on as our certain doom, and trying to widen my view to other forms of doom. And Anita sent me a chart that had like all the world's problems on it, and I was completely overwhelmed. And so I just sort of stuck my finger on something, and it was peak oil. And then 6 months later, I emerged from the abyss. But in that time, a number of things happened after coming across peak oil, and I don't know how, I assume most of you here are familiar with it, and possibly the process of getting into it. But those things included becoming persona non grata in my own family. I was not allowed to actually speak when I went upstairs anymore. After a while, I just stopped talking to strangers because it was just not a rewarding experience. You know, let me explain to you why everything you see is a mirage. See, none of this is real. When you go to the supermarket, those strawberries, they don't exist, right? What that led me to was a circle of friends. I'll talk about that in a sec, but it also led me to Kathy because I was really interested in the psychology of it, including my own psychology. I found Kathy just by email, and I think I sent her a copy of the rough cut or something, which she inexplicably liked, and we started corresponding, and we've been corresponding for 2 years or something now. Finally, we did speak on the phone actually once, and I got more marital therapy in an hour on the phone with this woman in Massachusetts than I'd gotten in 20 years of therapy previous to that. So if you want to get ripped up in a serious way by somebody who actually understands the issues, I recommend an hour on the phone with her. So that was kind of how I got to know her, and we talked about the psychology of why the world is not changing in the face of what we face. But you know, it's also more personal than that. It's also the way that we feel and the way that I felt, the struggles that I've gone through in a number of ways that she's going to talk about. But I wanted to say something that grew out of that was, you know, she sent me an email and said, hey, I'm coming to the West Coast. Do you think I could meet a few people? And now she's meeting like 1,000 people. And bringing her here, and Vandy's hosting her, Vandy Savage here, and we're kind of driving around, taking her to people. And what I notice as I take her to meet all the people here that are a lot of really cool people is that they're all my friends. Like, I'm taking her to meet my friends. And these are people I met through taking action around this issue and other issues. And I could say I'm taking her around to thought leaders or activists or whatever, but what they have in common is, like, they're all my friends and I love them. So I really encourage you, you know, I mean, Brennan has laid out some things to come do. You have no excuse to not know how to grow a chicken. And Ross is doing stuff all the time about, you know, how to feed yourself and how to transition. And I encourage you to do it to save your own life, but more than that, I encourage you because it is truly the end of loneliness. And I think it's a lot of what Kathy and I have in common, you'll hear, is just the answer is there. The answer is in just making more friends and getting closer to the people that you love. And she's one of those people for me. So anyway, I want to have her up now. Thanks.
Let me ask you here, how many of you are familiar with peak oil? Just raise your hand. And how many of you were freaked out when you heard about peak oil? Okay. And I ask that question because I think when you really get it on an emotional level, what we're talking about, and it happens in adulthood, because I know that some people get it when they're really young. And for them, they grew up knowing about peak oil, and so that by the time they became adults and it became something that was more common in the literature, they didn't have the same reaction as somebody who learned about it when they were an adult. So my experience in learning about peak oil was 5 years ago, and a friend of ours sent us told us about it, my husband and I, and I remember it really clearly because we were doing over our floor in wood, and so we moved into another bedroom, in this little tiny bedroom, and he would go to research peak oil, and then he would come back with printouts, and he'd hand them to me like this, and he'd go, read this. So I would read this stuff, and I'd go, wow, man. And a half hour later, he'd come in with another thing, and he'd go, read this. And he was a speed reader, so he was bringing stuff in a lot faster than I could comprehend. But it emotionally really upset me to the core, because I was a middle-class professional, and I, you know, just assumed that this here was normal. And so learning about peak oil was deeply disturbing to me, and I thought to myself, well, you know, what can I do? I'm a psychologist. And I thought, well, ding dong, you saw how nutty you acted, and they always say that psychologists are kind of nutty anyway, so I wanted to see if, in fact, the general public reacted to learning about peak oil in the same way that I did. So I started a website called Peak Oil Blues. And so what I did with Peak Oil Blues is basically ask people, what was your emotional reaction to learning about peak oil? Send me an email. And how did it change your life? What did you start to do differently than you did before? And so what happened is I got letters from people all over the world. I mean, I'm talking about tiny little specific islands, the Swiss Alps, you know, all over the United States, all over Canada. Australia has a really big, active peak oil movement, and I got a lot of letters from Australia. But literally, I had readers in every continent and people who would say to me, thank you. And that was the strongest reaction that I got. They kept saying, thank you for doing this for us. The experience was like talking to a community of people, because basically what I was saying to them is, oh yeah, yeah, that happened to me too. Oh yeah, I felt that exact same way. Oh yeah, well, here's what you're going to experience next. It wasn't just what I said to people who emailed me and posted, but it was also what people wrote in that was so reassuring to other people. And that's what one of the things that I'm going to go over tonight. So I'm going to cover these four issues, and I'm going to end up with talking about what I think are some of the basic strategies for keeping one's sanity through this whole process. So let me first talk about the dilemma. Peak oil is not a problem, because a problem has solutions. Peak oil is a dilemma. And the difference between a problem and a dilemma is a very important one psychologically. Because for a variety of reasons, people like to solve problems, but people hate dilemmas, because whichever way you go to try to mitigate a dilemma, you create other problems. And so for a lot of my readers, a lot of my contributors, they stopped knowing what to wish for. If they wished for the end of oil, they got a planet. But if they hoped that we would never run out of oil, they got dramatic climate change. So it was always between a rock and a hard place. So I want to talk to you about the person who first faced this dilemma. This is a picture of Cassandra, and she's a Greek character. She was given the gift to be able to predict the future, but unfortunately, she really ticked off Apollo, and he couldn't take away her powers, but what he did is say to her, you will never be believed when you tell people what's coming. So I want to introduce you to the first Cassandra that I was aware of in the United States, and this was President Jimmy Carter 33 years ago. He basically, and I want to tell you his story very briefly, but if you're interested, it's worth the time to go and to Google the energy speech for Jimmy Carter, and the speech is there, and it's in writing as well as him speaking it. But I'm going to give you a very brief version of what he said. He said, let me start with a history lesson on energy. He said, a long time ago, when we needed energy, we burned wood. And in fact, we burned so much wood that 90% of our energy needs were met with wood. After that, we discovered coal. And coal was such a much more intense form of energy for us that it enabled us to begin the Industrial Revolution and put a lot of people to work, a lot of children to work. And after that, we discovered this cool thing called natural gas and oil. And the one thing that we needed to understand about oil is that, according to Jimmy Carter, it was the densest energy source on the face of the planet. It was so dense that if you fill your tank with the stuff, you can move 2 tons of metal 350 to 400 miles. I mean, that's incredible amount of energy in a very little space. And I think it's hard for us to grasp how powerful and how concentrated oil actually is. So he basically said it gave us things like automobiles and airplanes. And the important thing he said is we have never known anything else. And this was 33 years ago, so it's even more true now, that we just assume that having access to natural gas and oil is natural. And he said the problem is that it's a finite substance, and we are burning through 60 million barrels of oil every single day across the planet. He said in 1950, we burned twice as much oil as we did in 1940, and in 1960, we burned twice as much as we did in 1950. And he said, in each of those decades, we burned more oil than the entire history of the planet. So he said, what has happened is that the United States is the most wasteful nation on Earth. And he said, we drive these gas-guzzling cars. He said, and it's the moral equivalent of war. So important is this energy issue, that we have to begin a campaign as a nation to rally around like we would a war to really tackle this issue seriously. He said we have to go on a very strict conservation program. We have to start to turn our heat down. We have to start insulating our homes because he said more oil is wasted going out our windows and walls than we import every year. So he said, we have to beef up our public transportation and get away from private automobiles. We have to turn towards alternative energies like solar and wind technology. And I'll show you how. So he said, first, turn your heat down, wear a sweater, you know, get your wife to wear a sweater, put a solar panel like I'm doing right here on the White House. And if you don't, here's the problem. And it was like the Lost in Space robot. He said, you know, warning, warning, there will be tremendous environmental damage if you don't do that. Here are some of the things he said are going to happen. He said, number one, we're going to be going into areas to try to get the last drops of oil in places that we don't want to go because it's going to create a huge mess for us. He said, we're going to go into areas to find coal and dig up and cut up the landscape in horrific ways. He said, we're going to start building nuclear power plants quickly. Think about that. Many of us don't want nuclear power plants built slowly. We certainly don't want them built at the speed of life, you know, or death, as the case may be. So he said, this is what we need to tackle. So then the election came, and we had a choice. Were we going to go with Debbie Downer and the First Lady Casual, who was wearing sweaters, or were we going to go with a cowboy? who basically would have wives and a wife in a lovely evening gown, you know, many, many evening gowns. And we could leave our heat up as high as we wanted. We could drive the big cars. It wasn't important. It didn't matter. And we would all make lots of money. And hooray, we would have a major party and take those stupid solar panels off the White House. So that's what we did. And we became the absurdly most wasteful nation on Earth. And instead of burning through 60 million barrels of oil a day, we burned through 84 million barrels a day across the world. But we only have one world. And 20% of us are taking and using up 80% of the stuff on Earth. What I want to talk about is that the psychological reactions that people have in living in this sort of environment. As I mentioned, a dilemma is not a problem. Here's a Woody Allen description of a dilemma. What it says is, mankind faces a crossroads. One path leads to despair and utter hopelessness, the other to total extinction. Let us pray we have the wisdom to choose correctly. So, you know, basically it'd say, would you like to be blind or would you like your tongue cut out? And people say, I don't want either of those, but that's what we're facing. Here's another definition. It's offering a solution or possibility, none of which are really practically acceptable. Or the Chinese who say, to advance or to retreat is equally difficult. That's what a dilemma is. And when you first learn about the dilemmas of peak oil, climate change, and economic hard times, my contributors were shocked, just as I was. They would, like I did, start to read intensively everything they could get their hands on. Now, here's the thing. The more scientifically oriented they were, the more nights they would spend not being able to sleep, working overtime to try to find that solution that would make everything better. Because they couldn't believe, if you're an engineer, you're taught, you're paid to solve problems. And so I'd have engineers writing to me and saying, this is the third night I have not been able to sleep, because usually I have a problem, I go to bed, and in the morning I've solved it, because I'm a really smart guy. But with peak oil, I haven't been able to solve it. And it's driving me crazy. Another reaction that's really common is that they feel like they're hitting up against an invisible wall. That no matter what they do, no matter what path they go down to try to grasp the intensity of this issue, it just feels like a dead end for them. The other common reaction, another one, is that how many of you have seen the movie The Matrix? If you've seen The Matrix, one of the things that you know is that they live in a pod, in a kind of dim, grim environment, but they're able to project themselves into a world that's much like our own. And when people first learn about peak oil, their experience is that they go and study about this stuff, living in this grim world of the future that they're anticipating. And then they go out and they take an airplane flight or they go into a supermarket. Everything is there for them. And it seems like they must be crazy. And so they go back into the pod, back into the reading, intensive reading. They learn more. They go back out. The outside world, the Matrix world, feels real to them initially. And that pod feels fake, despite the fact that they keep reading and they keep not being able to disprove what they're learning. But an interesting thing happens. After a while, they start to feel alienated from the Matrix. And they start to feel like that's not real. The pod is real. And so all of the things that they initially began to feel like they were going to miss once peak oil crashed, they now start to feel are needed to go away, because if it doesn't go away, our planet is going to crash. So people get to the point where they're not quite sure what to wish for, because anything they wish for will bring calamity. But I think that's a very interesting distinction and reaction and change that happens to people, that they start to become alienated from that very thing that they began to fear that they would miss terribly. Another reaction that they have that's very common is that what I call nostalgia for the present. They'll go into a supermarket and they'll look at a whole thing. We did it today. Fruit from all over the world, fish, meat, I mean, just overwhelmed by the choices. And they'll say, I remember when you could just go into a market and you could buy anything you wanted, and it was really cheap. And they felt crazy, because here they were in that market, and they could buy anything, and it was really relatively cheap. But they were in that pod, looking from those eyes, seeing how temporary and how illusionary it all was. Let me just say one more thing. They also would walk down a city street, and instead of seeing the cars in the parking lot and the buildings all lit up, they would see boarded up buildings and abandoned cars. I mean, obviously they wouldn't see it, but that's how they began to interpret the world around them, with that mask, if you will, of oil removed. The other thing that was very common among my contributors is a feeling of shame and guilt, because they began to become aware that they really were the 20% that were sucking up. They were big fat planet killers that were just sucking up all the resources, and that people everywhere else in the world were being used and exploited for them to be able to live a very luxurious life. So that shame was very powerful, and especially among my older contributors, who would feel like they had created a horrible nightmare for their children and their grandchildren. Depression was common. And one of the things I'm most proud of is before I started Peak Oil Blues, well, I'm not proud of this, but before I started, I got two stories of people, young men, who had killed themselves. And they're in their suicide note, it basically said, what's the point of living? We're going to be running out of oil. And when we do, I'm going to die anyway. So I don't want to live through a future like that, and I'm going to kill myself now. What I'm proud of is that since I started my website, I haven't heard another story like that. So I believe, based on that, and I know I would hear about it, I believe based on that that I am serving a function of having young people be able to write me and talk about it and see that the reactions that they're going through are not unusual and weird, and that there are things that they can do, which I'll talk about in a minute. We all have our various ways, you know. Being a psychologist, I use my adaptive strategies. Some of us, you know, are going to use more drugs and alcohol to manage the strain. But one of the things that I've come to grips with is that peak oil makes us all gamblers, and climate change for that matter, and even economic hard times ahead. And I got that because 5 years ago, I was aware, in fact, if you go into my site, you can research this. I wrote about the fact that we were going to be facing a bubble, or we had a bubble in our housing market, and it was going to explode. And yet here I was with a family business that was in that market. Did I close it down? No. I was betting on the lucky sevens. Every year that went by, I kept saying, okay, give me it, give me the number eight. I really, you know, I was a gambler. Because what I realized was the emotions that we were dealing with were going to be like this either way I went. If we sold the business, we'd have to sort of look into, now what are we going to do for a business? If we didn't sell the business, then we could at least hold on, hoping that the tracks would last a little longer. Because to get off that track meant we had to tip the train over, and that was going to be enormous amounts of damage. Again, a lot of my contributors felt like they were sitting on the train, they just ordered an aperitif, and they're waiting for dinner, and they look out the window, and this is what they're seeing ahead of them. But the most difficult problem that most of my contributors talk about extensively is the emotional reactions that they get when they start to talk about these issues with their friends and family. Even their spouses are often hostile to the idea that this is even a possibility. And so because we have names like Debbie Downer for people who believe that we're facing really serious problems in the future, I thought it would be helpful to talk about people who were pathologically hopeful. And I called them Panglossians. So I developed a category of Panglossian disorders. And I realized that all of us in the peak oil movement were like this Superman cartoon. You know, for those of you who are listening, you've got two Supermen having a beer. And one looks at the other and says, "Oh, man, you save people from themselves. Wow, that's a tough gig." And yet that's how we were feeling, that we couldn't do it alone. If we didn't have a community that was going to come along with us, we were even more doomed. So we try and talk with people, but instead of being receptive, we were feeling increasingly isolated, which is exactly what we didn't want to happen. We'd be sitting at the dinner table. "Well, dear," this is a family dinner table, "well, what do you want to be when you grow up, Jane?" And Jane says, "Well, Dad, I'd like to still be alive." And that's the seriousness with which my contributors were feeling that things had gotten to. So here's my definition of what happens when you go to a therapist to talk about this stuff and they have no clue what you're talking about. They tend to pathologize because they don't know any better. And so psychological terrorism is the phenomenon of pathologizing emotional reactions when they're perfectly appropriate given what the person is going through. I don't like the idea of categories like post-petroleum stress disorder. I think we have enough problems. We don't need to start pathologizing ourselves. Yes, we want to have our emotions be legitimized by professionals, but I don't think it's helpful to say that we're pathological because we're experiencing these things. So I'm going to give you a few Panglossian disorders that I'm going to go through kind of quickly with you. The first, of course, is just pure denial. You know, that can't be right. Oh, come on, you're making that up. Now, the difference between pure denial and somebody who just disagrees with you is that someone in pure denial doesn't bother to look into it, just rejects it out of hand because you said it. So it's like an electrician saying to you, "Your electricity in your house is so badly wired that it's going to burn up your house probably in the next 6 months." And you say, "Oh, go away. That's ridiculous." Okay? As opposed to saying, "Well, maybe I'll look and get a second opinion about that." So this would drive people crazy. They would say, "Look, why don't you just look into it, please? I'm married to you. I think our future is just blown up. I really want to take steps to protect our children, to change our lifestyle. Look into it." And they would hear from their spouses or their families, "No, I don't need to look into it. I don't want to look into it."
We'll be right back in just a minute with more Radio EcoShock. We'll play you the second part of a speech by Kathy McMahon, recorded October 18th in Vancouver, Canada. She's the Peak Oil Shrink.